This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast, the very best bits of today's show. It is a Thursday. It is the 15th of September. Tom and I in the studio this morning. Brandy Scott is not here because she, frankly, had a better offer. She's in the United States, Washington, D.C., with the great and the good of the aviation industry. She's with Sir Tim Clark, the president of Emirates Airline and the boss of United Airlines. And that's because they've done what my kids would call a collab. They have got together. Going to get details on that shortly. And then a little bit later on, going to hear from the boss of Emirates Airlines, Sir Tim Clark, who sat down with Brandy in an aircraft hangar at Dulles Airport. What else have we got for you? The IPO frenzy continues. We've been launching a new feature actually today on the Business Breakfast. Really excited about this one with our friends at Dubai Financial Markets, looking in more detail at things like the IPOs happening at the moment. Aladdin Aldisi of Mashreq Bank has been speaking to us about that. And finally, real estate, Sarah Hewardine of Hauser answering your questions. All that to come. First up, though, let's jump straight into that big story. Emirates Airline, United Airlines, Brandy Scott. Thomas, who is not here?
Brandy Scott is not here.
She is in absentia, but she does have a good excuse because she's been in Washington, D.C., or she is in Washington, D.C., hanging out with the great and the good of the aviation industry. A big deal announced, as Serena just mentioned there, between Emirates Airline and United. We'll hear from Tim Clark in detail this hour on the Business Breakfast. But first up, let's hear from Brandy herself. I caught up with her a couple of hours ago in her Toe Hotel room in Washington, D.C., and this is what she told me.
So it was held at Dulles International Airport in a maintenance hangar. And the most interesting thing about it was right at the beginning, they pulled the hangar doors back, which takes a good 3 minutes, by the way, to reveal two 777s, one from each airline. Been to a lot of press conferences in my time, Richard. I can tell you it was probably the most dramatic, certainly the largest background that I've ever seen anybody have.
Good stuff. So what did we learn?
So what we learned is that this is a commercial partnership. It's the beginnings of a commercial partnership. In a nutshell, we are going to see Emirates passengers being able to hop really easily onto 200-odd destinations in the US on the United network, ditto for United customers hopping onto the Emirates and the Fly Dubai network, so 400 destinations between the two of those. As well as that, you're going to see United flying again, as they used to do back in the day, into Dubai. They're going to be doing that out of Newark in New York. And the usual stuff that comes with code share, which is starting with three cities, Houston, San Francisco, and the third is Chicago. So that's going to start with the code share, and then other cities will follow.
So what was the tone like? Because there have been disagreements between these airlines, quite significant ones in the past.
Yeah, and that was referenced by both CEOs. Well, with the United CEO, Scott Kirby, and the Emirates president, Sir Tim Clark. Both of them referred to the fact that it was quite amazing that they had come together like this. Both of them spoke about how similar the airlines were in their growth in the pandemic and all the similarities that they had. That was quite a big point. Sir Tim actually standing up in a United aircraft hangar said, if this had been 7 years ago, you would have been throwing tomatoes at me.
Finally, what was the Brandy Scott take on the whole thing, the announcement, the setting, the various other things that happened around it?
What I get from it, and you're going to be listening to my interview with Sir Tim a little bit later on this morning, but what I get from it is that this is the very beginning. He kept using the metaphor about acorns growing into trees. When I also spoke to the CCO of Emirates, Adnan Kazim, he spoke about phases, phase one, phase two, phase three. They're not starting with all the cities that Emirates flies into in the US with the full code share. They're just starting with three. Some of the others have the same links for you and me. So, you know, we'll still get the same ticket and stuff, you know, baggage all the way through, all the easy stuff from our point of view. But the full code share isn't there for a couple of the other cities. So this is something that is definitely happening in stages. But Sir Tim basically said that there's no limit to how far this partnership can go between the two.
That is Brandy Scott speaking to us from her Washington hotel room just a couple of hours ago. As she said there, we are going to hear the full interview with Sir Tim Clark. It's live on the Business Breakfast in about half an hour's time, around about 7:40 a.m. If you miss it, don't worry. It's going to be on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. But this is a sneak preview. This is Sir Tim explaining to Brandy what the deal includes.
Well, Emirates and United come to that, putting together a major partnership, multiple co-share arrangements. So we will give them access to our seats beyond Dubai, and we will get access to a lot of their seats in the United States. We start with Chicago, Houston, and San Francisco, but I'm hoping that the whole thing will grow into something akin to the Qantas arrangement that we have today.
This is good news. Selfishly and personally speaking, it comes about 3 weeks a little too late for Tom, who had to pick up bags in San Francisco and then get on a United down to Aspen, etc.
United 3 weeks ago?
Oh, yes.
Because just to recap, if you weren't listening, Tom was in the United States 3 weeks ago for work. He had an event with Prince Harry, a polo event in Aspen, Colorado.
Yeah.
And you flew Emirates
to San Fran and then had to pick up my bag. And I asked the question here, said any chance in the bag? Oh, no chance. What do you mean? Come on, we all know that the genie's not out of the lamp just yet, but we know what's going on. So you had to pick up your bag in San Fran and then go to a different terminal and check in again. So it was,
To be fair, you were only there for 36 hours. It wouldn't have been a very big bag.
I know, but in the same breath, Richard, it's that whole thing, and people will understand that. Once you've got that, the nice thing about these co-chairs is that you literally check your bag in and they pick it up at your final destination and you can relax. When you don't, you spend the flight sort of second-guessing yourself, going, well, do I need to pick it up or do I not need to pick it up, and asking other people and trying to get more information, etc., because that's the nature of the beast. So that side, the other side of it, and not so selfishly, but just for others, is that I hope they're going to put more services on. Because this in turn means, you know, as you heard from Sir Tim there, opening up their seats for further destinations, it's going to generate more passengers out of the United States and to and from the United States. It means more bums on seats on Emirates. And anyone trying to get onto an Emirates flight at the moment will know there ain't many seats available.
I mean, you struggled, didn't you?
No, I mean, everyone is. That's without saying. So hopefully this comes with, and I know that they are looking to ramp up services at the moment, but more and more services, because availability at the moment is a big issue.
Because you're going to have United flying back into Dubai again, aren't you, from Newark, which is good news.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right then, talking aviation now. Brandy Scott is not here. She is in Washington, D.C. for the announcement of what United Airlines boss Scott Kirby yesterday called the worst kept secret in aviation, a partnership between his airline and Dubai's Emirates. Now, the pair have effectively created a codeshare plus for Emirates. It opens up more than 200 odd US cities on the United network. In return, United gets access to 400 plus destinations, not just through Emirates, but also through Fly Dubai. The move will also see United flying once again to Dubai, DXB, from Newark Airport, just outside New York. Now, it's particularly extraordinary, analysts say, because it was only 7 years ago that the two were pitted against each other, with the big three US carriers, including United, accusing the big three Gulf carriers, including Emirates, of government subsidies and unfair competition. So, let's get more detail. Brandy sat down with Emirates President Sir Tim Clark in an aircraft hangar at Dulles International Airport in Washington, D.C. Hence, you will hear the clanging and the banging in the background, where an actual plane was being moved. And Sir Tim began by explaining the benefit to Emirates of this deal.
Well, Emirates and United come to that, putting together a major partnership, multiple co-share arrangements. So we will give them access to our seats beyond Dubai, and we will get access to a lot of their seats in the United States. We start with Chicago, Houston, and San Francisco, but I'm hoping that the whole thing will grow into something akin to the Qantas arrangement that we have today.
How big could it get, Sir Tim?
So long as we are all on the same page, I can see a limitless arrangement. It's limited, of course, by geography, simply because, you know, we are not a US carrier, they're not a... But if you put the two together in a manner that we can seriously flesh out the consumer footfall, if you like, then I believe this will be something quite big.
Could we see Emirates flying to more US destinations that United serves?
We could see that and some. So we have 12 today. We have fairly ambitious plans now to push that out to quite a few more. I'm not going to say how many and what they are, because my competitors will take advantage of that. But certainly that there are significant expansion plans for North America, as there are for South America. So with that and what United may do, then it's a win-win situation.
This deal will see United flying from New York into Dubai. Why are they doing that? Isn't that competing against you?
Not really. Their Newark operation will start in March of next year. It's a non-stop operation. It's a timing that doesn't compete with us. It complements us, and it meets a demand which they need. Somebody needed to put that in place because it's growing at pace. And don't forget, Dubai itself is moving at an extraordinary pace now. People are pouring in, a lot of tourism going in, a lot of business going in. So I don't worry about that at all.
How much is this a product of the times? The pandemic, the recovery, even the issues with Ukraine and Russia?
I think perhaps more for United than for us. I think Scott Kirby's team realised that they probably needed to redirect the business internationally going forward post the pandemic. They couldn't do it all. They couldn't reach, but they recognised what they could have if they worked with a quality partner. And so for them, it's a very good thing. For us, I have to say, we have always aspired to have a heavyweight US partner. Notwithstanding the difficulties of 7 years ago, I always said to them, despite in the middle of all of this, it makes far more sense to work with us than against us, because we will bring you to the table a feast of opportunity.
What has it taken to make former enemies become friends like this?
Well, you know, life moves on, it's water under the bridge. The recognition that what was in the past is in the past. Importantly, we were always receptive. So United basically had, I think, concluded on the long lines, I've said, that they needed to do something with somebody in that area, and what better than Emirates.
How much of this is about the passengers that you can reach that United can't? You, of course, can fly over Russian airspace at the moment, and because of sanctions, United can't.
Yeah, that didn't really enter into the calculations. Obviously, the fact that we can fly to 107 cities on our network that are materially interesting to United, obviously they don't want to fly to London or Paris or whatever, but beyond Dubai, and add to that Fly Dubai as well, is huge. So for those passengers who might have... I was just talking to somebody who wanted to go to the Maldives on United. It was almost impossible to get there. Whereas from here, with them or us, you can do Dubai one stop and three or four, five flights a day into the Maldives. Everything is much easier for them. They don't have to have the visa problem. They don't have the huge transfer problem, airline change problem, etc. So that'll be attractive to all the consumers who hitherto had never gone there. The United vast consumer base.
Could we see other regional tie-ups from Emirates like this? Where else could you do something like this?
Well, we've already got one with Air Canada. We're in the early days of an Air France arrangement. My own view is that this will unlock quite a lot of interest in what we do from other players. And they've all seen how Qantas and Emirates have worked very well since 2012. We've had 10 years of that, and they realise that alliance or non-alliance, that this really works when two like-minded carriers want to get the job done with the customer right in the centre of the mix.
What about the quality disconnect? I know United has increased its business class, but they're talking about new planes with larger overhead bins, and you're talking about unlimited caviar.
Well, yeah, look, each has its merits. So I'm not saying that United's going to put unlimited caviar, okay? But whatever the attractions are, you know, it's a product that will come up. Scott is trying to improve what they do in the premium and also in economy as well. New aircraft coming in, etc. So in the end, it's a realization that the consumers are pretty demanding. And when Emirates comes along with what I call the gold standard, so mimicked by my peer group in the region, you know you've got it right. But whatever that may be, the fact is that people are expecting to be treated better cuisine, better seat comfort, privacy, and all the other bits and pieces. They're doing that. And in the end, it'll work.
That is the voice of Sir Tim Clark. He's the president of Emirates Airline, and he's on fine form in Washington, D.C., Tom. Is he not? Unlimited caviar?
Shooting from the hip.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, much mimicked by my peers in the region. Good on you, Tim. Yeah,
I like that line.
Yeah. Was he wearing a Stetson at the time as well or not?
Absolutely no idea.
No, saying it as it is, quite right too. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I'm glad Brandy asked about the question at the end. Yeah, United and Emirates brand value in terms of, I mean, recognisable brand value, great. But in terms of brand value as to what that brand represents, quite different. And therefore, how do they square that circle?
And it is, it's a different culture of service.
Oh.
The service is very good in the United States in many ways. Service is very good here in the UAE in many ways. But it is a different culture of service, isn't it? And we haven't got time to go into that now, but it's probably an interesting one to discuss.
Taking stock with the Dubai Financial Market, sustainably accelerating business and individual wealth.
Yes, indeed. As Richard was suggesting, their new segment here and something we're very much looking forward to, opening the lid and explaining some of the big business stories, the big financial stories of the day and the week. And they don't get much bigger than IPOs at the moment. We've had a few in recent weeks, but none as big as the Salik one, which is currently open for business at the moment. Salik has priced its IPO very competitively at present. Gaylon Moore, head of cash equity, BHM Capital Financial Services, joined us yesterday morning to talk about the IPO. 2 dirhams a share, Gaylon. What did you make of the numbers there?
A lot of people expected the IPO to price around 250, 2.5 dirhams a share. So this is on the lower end of expectations. Quite often we've seen in the past that there's a range of pricing that the IPO is done at. So, for instance, you'd get a range of 2 to 220 as the range. So what the what they've done with the Salik IPO is actually set a firm price. So this gives investors a lot of confidence that they know the price they're going to pay when they subscribe to the IPO.
So IPO, giving you confidence, but also very attractive, which prompts many to go, all right, stop telling me about it and how attractive it is. How do I get my hands on it? Well, we've got the man that can help with that, because the EVP, head of Mashreq Gold Plus and Distribution at Mashreq Bank, man who looks after Mashreq Wealth across all of its guises, is, of course, Mr. Aladdin El-Disi, who joins us now live in studio. Aladdin, thank you so much indeed for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Let us talk about the process, if we can, because come on, let's be honest, not our first rodeo. We've all been here for quite some time. We've seen the evolution of the banking service, and with that, the IPO service. I know that you've worked in the banking service for several years here. How has the subscription, the IPO subscription process, changed over time?
It has really transformed. You know, if we look back at how IPO subscription used to be, and I remember from the days I used to be a relationship manager myself, and we had people queuing in branches just to get subscription forms and be part of IPO subscriptions, you know, back in 2005, 2006. So as soon as the Dubai government announced that they want to list 10 GREs, we got together as a team in Mashreq and we decided that we're not going to go through this journey again of manual subscription. And the team put their heads together and started working hard on developing a digital IPO subscription similar to what we see in certain countries in Asia and Europe. And we reached out to the DFM team and the NASDAQ team, actually, and a big thank you to Hamad Ali and his team for the collaboration that happened between the two teams in coming up with the digital IPO journey that I'm going to discuss with you. It basically makes it easy for all clients to subscribe for an IPO, which started off with Diwa and now we got to Salik, at any point in time in a day and from the comfort of their mobile.
I'm actually on the YouTube channel at the moment, Mashreq Bank's YouTube channel. And also you've done a sort of a video. A couple of videos that, that basically walk you through the process. Is that sort of indicative of the new simplicity of getting involved?
Yes, it's pretty simple. Anybody who operates a mobile and has a bank account with Mashreq can easily, you know, take that process through. And it has all the information. It has information about the IPO. It takes you through the information of how to subscribe. Even if a client doesn't have a NIN, a national investor number, through the integration we set up with DFM, you can generate your NIN by being on that app alone. You don't have to go back to any other app. So you set up your NIN. We have a facility of opening your brokerage account from the same application. So from the same application, you set up your Mashreq Securities account, and then the debit happens from your personal account in Mashreq. And then you go straight through. Once you put in the NIN, it gives you the list of brokers that you are listed with in DFM. You choose where you want your shares to be deposited. And after that, you just set up the amount. Even we went a step further and offered leverage digitally to clients. So eligible clients will get an option whether they want to leverage their subscription up to a certain limit. And you get a nice congratulations message saying that your subscription has gone through.
And that's brilliant, Aladdin. But in some ways, because me, you and Tom remember the mid-2000s and the IPO frenzy there. Is there not a bit of you that misses the good old days where people would turn up on a flight from Jeddah with two suitcases full of riyals?
Actually, it's not,
there's
it's
a certain
not
romance
only Jeddah.
About it.
Yeah, it was a hassle, you know. Nobody wants to wake up in the morning just to go in a bank, let alone stand in a queue and get a service done. You know, by offering things digitally, it was both beneficial to banks as well as to clients. You know, I don't have to take a decision on something like this between, you know, 8 and 3 when the branches are open. I might be actually thinking about this sometime late in the evening after the kids are asleep. I decide, I've seen the news, I take a decision, and the bank is there at that time of the night, you know, through the digital services that are there.
Is this indicative? I mean, we're sort of focusing on the IPO subscription at the moment and facilitating it for a new audience. Is this indicative of sort of Mashreq Bank approach to digitization of all financial services at the moment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything we design, everything we build is based on data and feedback that we get from clients and customer behavior that we see in branches. Our direction is basically to be available for our clients 24/7. And the best way to be available in that in designing digital journeys to actually service those clients. Now, even a step before the IPO journey, we also have self-digital onboarding. So if a client doesn't have an account with Mashreq, he can get on the website or the application, upload his or her documents, okay, and boom, he has an account. And even, you know, after getting the account, they can go for the IPO subscription. So it's open for all clients.
Lastly, do we still get that relationship with the broker? And you've had a long history in wealth management where we can sit down and go over a cup of coffee in the evening, Aladdin, bottom line, is this a good deal or not? Should I buy or should I not? With all the digitization and all the regulation that there is now, all of which are positive, can you still give that honest advice to your clients?
Yes, we didn't say that physical has gone completely. You know, physical is still there and our branches are still there. We have a big number of relationship managers who manage accounts and they are still reachable for their clients. However, clients, if they choose, you know, to go through a digital journey, that's also available.
But
if they're looking
they give,
for advice. Yeah.
Can they give like a buy, sell or hold recommendation? So in like a 6 weeks time when Salik's listed and D was listed, can they give an honest buy, sell or hold recommendation?
They usually don't. Relationship managers usually don't give a buy, sell or hold. They're not advisors, so to say. But they are there to help the client, give him the information that is required to make a wise and rational decision.
Aladdin, we've got to leave it there. Unfortunately, the news just around the corner. We could talk for a lot longer, but thank you so much indeed for your time
Tom.
This morning.
Thank you, Richard.
Aladdin Al-Disi is the EVP, head of Mashreq Gold Plus and Distribution at Mashreq Bank.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We have the head of marketing at Houses, Sarah Hureddine. Sarah, good morning. Nice to have you with us in the studio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Last time you were with us, you were live on Microsoft Teams from Bali, but you're back in Dubai this time.
I am. I can't lie. I do miss it a little bit.
The summer holidays are a distant memory for most of us now. And today, we're talking about suburbia. Why is suburbia on your mind?
So what we have noticed recently in the Dubai market, as everybody has in the core villa communities, the key communities, prices have really skyrocketed. So what we've actually noticed is the suburbs of Dubai gaining a lot more popularity, a lot more people migrating out there, getting a cheaper price per square foot. And I think it's definitely a trend that we're seeing within the last year, but I think we're going to see a lot more activity come in the next 12 months as well.
When I think of suburbs, I mean, let's have a mm-hmm. definition. I mean, I immediately think of America, 1950s, 1960s, the post-war boom. That's when the suburbs really grew up and sitcoms based in suburbia. How are you defining a suburb?
So I think the way I really define a suburb is anything beyond Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Road, the other side. So we're talking further out communities, past the ranches, Mudon, really along the Al-Qudra corridor, Motor City, Sports City. So it's really all of that side of Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed where we're seeing what I define as more of a suburb is very... one person could say one thing, one person could say another. But I think collectively, when you talk about real estate, and I speak to a lot of people on the ground, that's really what we're classing as the suburbs of Dubai now.
It's interesting. Just a quick personal aside, if you'll indulge me for a second. We bought our house, my wife and our family, seven, 8 years ago here in Dubai. And the one criteria that my wife had, and she's born and raised in Dubai, she said, I want to be the right side of the 311, the Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Road. Mm. So we live in Barsha South. And it's a community there, and it's like many, many other communities, and it's fine. But I remember her saying, I'm not going, is it south of the 311 or whatever, but further out than that.
Yeah.
That was her definition.
And I think, yeah, and I definitely think that's the perception a lot of people have, is you think, I don't want to be on the sticks of Dubai. I don't want to be, you know, the furthest point out. But we're a city, we're a developing city. As a city expands, the suburbs expand. And I think what is, you know, the town square of today that you think you're on the edge of Dubai, give it 10 years, you won't be. And I think that's just how, you know, how cities develop.
Well, again, my second self-indulgent real estate story of the day. So please forgive me. But when I bought my first home in Dubai, which was 2003, an apartment in the Greens, and it felt like the absolute middle of nowhere. You could not get a taxi there for love nor money.
Yeah.
And obviously now it's the heart of Dubai.
Yeah, exactly that. And Andrew and I were just talking in the green room about, you know, you might want to go out for some drinks, but you live in Town Square. How do you get back? That's such a far, you know, half an hour drive. You get a safe drive if you need to. And I think that it's become a lot more accessible. And I think, you know, roads have developed, communities have developed. You get a lot more for your money out there as well. And I think if you're buying in Dubai with a longer term horizon, then you're willing to, you know, have that further out commute that may be far out now, but like I say, give it 10-15 years and you're actually going to be what I guess maybe not the Greens of today, but you're definitely a lot closer to the city.
And you've been crunching the numbers because that's what you do at Houser. I mean, and the numbers are compelling. So you've been comparing, is it a three-bedroom townhouse in the Burbs on that side of the Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, or a three-bedroom townhouse in, you're using Dubai Hills, an example, which is on Al Kail Road, is a little bit closer to town. And it's almost half the price out in the suburb. Not quite, but almost half the price. What are the numbers?
So you're looking at around 1.6 if you want to get a three-bedroom townhouse in somewhere like Town Square. If you're going to look in Dubai Hills, you're looking at around 2.7. 2.7 to 3, depending, you know, where you're at. That's a similar, you know, plot size, a similar unit size of around just over 2,000 square foot. But when you look at the price per square foot, you're looking at around 700 dirham a square foot in Town Square. You compare that to Dubai Hills and you're looking at around 1,500 dirham. And I think this is the reason I picked those two communities is because when you look at Dubai Hills, a lot of people moved there in 2020. pre-pandemic, even post-pandemic, rents were very cheap. It was a really well thought of community in a great location. Rents have gone crazy. Prices have gone up. And those that lived there originally, a lot of young families, they have now thought, rents have increased. If we want to buy and want to buy a similar unit, we can't afford to buy here. So we have to look further out. And there definitely is a lot of migration of younger families moving towards places like Town Square because they just simply cannot afford the places like Dubai Hills.
And it's a similar story with the rents. Again, we all live here. We all know people. The stories of, you know, my landlord's put up my rent by 60%. And I've just got to move out. I mean, those stories are seemingly endless at the moment, aren't they? We know we have the rental committee, but we also know there's a game that landlords play.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, and we've touched on this before, but rents were, in my view, were quite undervalued before this kind of rallying that we've seen. So I think we just got used to those rent prices. And when you look even at rent registrations in those communities around Town Square, Moudon, actually, rental registrations are similar on par the increase that you've seen across all of Dubai. But we have had a lot more new supply come into those areas. So there's definitely more end users buying up there. But you definitely do have some investors buying in those areas with good yields, which means that then more renters are moving out there as well.
Oh, right. So people are buying it to rent out, to be a landlord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're definitely finding there's a good portion of that. I think that's becoming more popular. Yields are very strong around there. You've got around 6-7% gross yields. So I think you've definitely got a lot more investors that are willing to look out there and look again with a longer term horizon.
Are the banks still willing to lend at these valuations at the moment? Because valuations are a little bit higher at the moment. And we know bankers are cautious by nature. Loan to value ratios are something that they look at. You mentioned 2.7, 2.8 million dirhams for a small townhouse in Dubai Hills. Is a bank going to look at that and get it valued by, I don't know, a Cluttons or whoever it is, and still give out the home loan for that?
Yeah, so to be honest with you, I can't give a direct answer as to, you know, if there's any changes around that. From what I've seen and what I've spoken to with mortgage providers, there hasn't been a huge difference in terms of what they're willing to loan against. Again, you look at those prices and you think, you know, how inflated they are. But again, you compare it to other cities and you actually think maybe this is what the value of this home should be in this proximity, 10 minutes from downtown, 10 minutes from the marina. So I think there definitely is that kind of stigma around the fast increase. But when it comes to mortgages, I haven't heard otherwise.
And deals are being done. I'm looking at your data from Hauser and you say, when looking collectively at the suburban community, so the other side of the 311, the Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Road, sales in the third quarter of this year, and we're almost done now, what are we, 15th of September, not quite, but almost done, are pretty much double to the third quarter last year in terms of the number of deals being done. Just 45 seconds on that.
Yeah, exactly that. So you have had new supply into those areas. So these are areas like Town Square, Rimram, Moudon. So you definitely have had more supply into, which lends itself more to an increase in those numbers. But even if you look at the Springs, the Meadows, Dubai Hills, and look at those communities, you've only seen around a 25% increase in Q3 on those transaction numbers, but you're seeing a much larger increase in the further suburbs of Dubai. So a lot more activity happening there. I think it offers end users and investors, a very good opportunity to be a home buyer rather than continuing paying inflated rents. It'll be interesting to see what actually happens as Dubai expands over the years.
Keep your messages coming, 4001. You can download the ARN Play app and message us for free. Matt's been in touch. Thanks very much indeed. Others have as well. But for now, Sarah Hewardine of Hauser, appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.